He's facing an uphill battle in a conservative-leaning district, but candidate Jess Selmont is hoping to ride a blue wave into Congress. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, we'll speak with Democratic candidate for Congress Jess Selmont, seeking to upset incumbent John Rutherford. What are the stakes in the midterms? Get on the line now with your thoughts and comments at 549-2937. Speaking of voting, today is the deadline to register to vote in Florida and Georgia. What you need to do to make sure you can cast your ballot. And later in our book club, we'll take a look at one of the picks on the PBS Great American Read, Their Eyes Were Watching God. All of that ahead this morning. But first, this hour, he has staked out a long shot bid to unseat Jacksonville area Congressman John Rutherford. Democrat Jess Selmont of Ponte Vedra Beach is Rutherford's opponent in the November 6th primary. It's an uphill battle as the district leans Republican, and Rutherford has strong name recognition and the power of the incumbency going into re-election. We should point out we asked Congressman Rutherford to join today's program with his opponent, and his office did not respond. So we welcome to Studio 5 Democrat Jess Selmont, candidate for the 4th Congressional District here in Florida, to talk about the campaign. Jess, good to meet you. Good morning.
Well, thanks a lot, Melissa. It's great to be here. It's a thrill. I'm a fan of the show.
Well, thanks so much. And what are your questions for the candidate as we speak with Jess Selmont? The number to join us, 549-2937. That's 549-2937, or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page. Okay, in a minute, we'll talk about your positions and your background, but first, I simply have to ask you, why are you doing this in a district as gerrymandered as Florida's 4th, where Rutherford is a virtual shoo-in to win? Yes, there is a predicted blue wave this fall, but still, this is not a district that the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, is throwing money at. This is not a district that's seen as flippable. So why do it?
Well, I think I'd have to disagree with a little bit of what you said in terms of how you position this. Certainly back in February when we declared, this looked like a very, very difficult district to win. But as we have been out there for the last 7 months, meeting with people, meeting probably 150 different groups in 180 different days, we have found that there's pent-up demand for Democratic candidates. And second, there's large dissatisfaction with John Rutherford, who has been a mostly absent and unreachable, as your staff has found, congressman.
Rutherford has held a number of fundraisers and some events in the district since being elected. At the same time, he hasn't held any town halls during his term in Congress. He hasn't met with any groups that want to talk about events involving, say, the environment or gun reform in Florida. So he has drawn criticism on those points. But let's talk about your campaign. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I would say that just to tag on what you said, when the high school students in town had their town hall for our lives back in the spring, they invited John Rutherford to show up. He did not show up, and I sat on stage next to an empty chair that they put an empty suit on that chair. So his absence in the district is being noticed by everybody from children to adults. Our campaign has been phenomenal. We have raised, last count, over $50,000 in small money donations. That is hundreds and hundreds of retired school teachers, retired social workers, pensioners, college students, working families, donating $5, $10, $25 to us. And it's it's a point that A.G. Kankarski, your buddy, pointed out in his website, that we don't have much money in the bank. And that's because we feel an obligation to spend the money that people donate to us. All the money that people give to us have gone to targeted internet ads, digital billboards on I-95, great events that we're throwing. We're just spending our money and spending it wisely. And I think we should get credit as a campaign for doing more with less and, frankly, being very efficient with your donations.
So you're getting a lot of small dollar donations. At last count, your opponent, John Rutherford, had more than $300,000 on hand. So it's an uphill money battle.
We feel like we've done everything to date that we have wanted to do financially. We don't feel that finances hold our campaign back. If we needed more money, we would be more aggressive about going out and getting it. What we have is a limited media market here in Jacksonville with, even though it's a top 50 media market, television-wise, it's very inexpensive to advertise here. And we're able to get our message out really through targeted Facebook ads, which is where we think people are, and through the grassroots of canvassing and rallies, mm-hmm. et cetera.
Let's talk about your positions.
Sure.
You're a Democrat. Your opponent's a Republican. If you were elected to the 4th District in Florida, what would be your biggest priorities for this district?
Sure. Well, talking about the district, we are at a crucial point in the First Coast. We have essentially allowed developers to run our planning. And we had a skyscraper, quite frankly, that flooded in the last tropical storm. And we have a congressman, congressional delegation that have done nothing to address a resiliency for our downtown. We have in the 4th District, which, just to define it for people out there who might not have an encyclopedic knowledge of congressional districts, the 4th District is Nassau County, half of Duval County, and almost 90% of St. John's County. So it runs from the Georgia border down to St. John's County, past the amphitheater. 735,000 people, a number of military bases, suburban sprawl, urban hipster neighborhoods, the oldest city in America, and farms. So it's an incredibly economically diverse district. We need to have a congressman and congressional delegation that has a vision for the future of Jacksonville. John Rutherford has had the opportunity to set forth a vision for Jacksonville, and he hasn't set one forth. And that's where this campaign is moving forward. We're setting forth a vision for this district. You know, every time it rains, the business districts in Fernandina, San Marco, St. Augustine flood. Parking spaces flood. Businesses have sandbags on their front steps. Every time there's a thunderstorm, somebody in the 4th District comes home to find the clock on their microwave is flashing because the power's gone out. So how do we preserve the great quality of life that we have here that most people have relocated here for? And that's by keeping our taxes low and attracting businesses here. What sales pitch do we have as a city and a region if our sales pitch is move your business here, the power goes out when it rains, and our cities flood? So we feel that putting forward a good vision of for business and for lifestyle is what makes our campaign different than John Rutherford.
549-2937 to connect with Jess Selmont. He is running for Congress against incumbent Congressman John Rutherford. Give us a call. Okay, so yeah, locally in this area, there has not been much political will to aggressively respond to the threats posed by sea level rise and more extreme weather events.
Certainly.
How would you address that?
Well, it's really something that we're trying to press down on localities. We're trying to get individual cities to have a response to what is a global problem, which is the rise of tides. And politically, where your listeners fall on climate change is irrelevant to this. I think anybody who's lived here for more than 5 years knows there's less sand on the beach. The water is encroaching on us. And it is such a massive task that it isn't something that we can expect the city of St. Augustine or Fernandina Beach or Amelia Island or Ponte Vedra to tackle on their own with their own budget. And in a lot of cases with citizen legislators, you know, with people who work day jobs and show up at night to volunteer to be on a planning board. So it really requires a federal government initiative. And that's where mm-hmm. your Congress people have to take their heads out of the sand and admit that the tide is rising and fund resiliency efforts for the whole St. John's River watershed.
What about other issues? For example, the port, job creation. A minute ago, you mentioned let's create a more business-friendly climate with low taxes.
Sure. Well,
that honestly sounds more like what the Republican candidate would say. So how would you do that differently?
Well, I think it goes back to the theme of our campaign, which is that there are ways to do more with less and to be efficient. And that's what we're about, is about being smart. Taking a dot-com approach to being smarter, making smarter decisions and spending your money better. I come from a background of lean startups, and that is creating businesses where you're not funded to the hilt and you have to be really, 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 frankly, brilliant. And I don't see brilliance in our government right now. And that's what we need to add to it. You know, here in Jacksonville, the mayor is exploring pawning the electric utility because the congressional district, the 4th, 5th, and 6th, has not brought home brownfields remediation money for the shipyards, which are contaminated from their days as munitions factories with lead and mercury and hard metals. So the mayor is actually exploring pawning off the utility to be able to clean up those brownfields because no developers will touch that land. That's why we need a congressional delegation that's working together and trying to come up with creative solutions to solve the problems. I think it's telling that Congressman Rutherford boasts about money he's obtained for deepening the harbor, which brings more water into a city that floods, than any efforts that he has made to protect us from flooding.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with 4th District Congressional candidate, Democrat Jess Salmont. He's running against John Rutherford for Congress. We did ask Congressman Rutherford to join the show today to debate the issues. His office didn't respond. So let's go to your calls now for the candidate. What are your questions and comments? 549-2937. Give us a call. Kathy is in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Kathy. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you. As a Democrat, I just wanted to say it would be really great, I think, if you could really talk about your, you know, your contrast with Mr. Rutherford in bullet points, you know, things that really affect people like health care, minimum wage, water. You know, you're talking about flooding. I mean, but just really talk about it in a way that it's not, you know, these big kind of ideas, but really, you know, maybe some small steps that you would take that would really start to improve the discussion. I think I really feel that will touch people, and that's what people are looking for, answers. Maybe stating the problem and then your answer to the problem. I really feel like that would be a way to get people to see you as someone who's a problem solver. So anyway, that's my two cents. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. I think, you know, whatever political affiliation people have, I think that's what all voters want to hear right now. So what about that?
Sure. And on a morning where the governor is interrupting the newscast with news of a hurricane hitting the Gulf, you know, we've certainly taken the first few minutes here to talk about resiliency and flooding and infrastructure. And I know that puts a lot of people to sleep. And it's very important that we get out to people as Democrats that we're not an opposition party. We're not going to win next month as an opposition party, as a party that's against everything. We have to win as a party of ideas. You know, when I see somebody driving down the street who has a Trump bumper sticker or a Trump hat, I don't get mad. I get heartbroken that's somebody who thought that a billionaire game show host had more to offer them than our Democratic Party, the Democratic Party of Joe Biden and President Obama and Bill Clinton and Robert Kennedy and FDR. You know, what we're running on this year is good Democratic values. Protecting
are you for Medicare? Are you for Medicare for all, for example, like gubernatorial candidate Andrew Gillum? Let's talk healthcare for a
sure.
minute.
Sure. Well, talking healthcare, first thing is that I'm 100% behind protecting a woman's right to choose and protecting women's access to affordable healthcare outside of what goes on with the Affordable Care Act. I have stated publicly that I support Senator Chris Murphy in Connecticut, his plan to expand Medicare. I think that there's no way to get to healthcare for all until you have cost containment in the healthcare system. And so while I certainly think that's a goal, there's an intermediate step. You can't have an EpiPen that saves a kid's life from a bee sting or a peanut cost $500. And, you know, that was the bargain that was made by Nancy Pelosi and President Obama when they were passing Obamacare. You know, they believed that they were going to keep Congress and they would have an opportunity then in a second effort, modify the Affordable Care Act to put cost containment into it. And because they lost Congress, we've never had that opportunity to put cost containment back into the system. And that's what's necessary before I believe you can talk about insuring everybody.
Okay. Other big positions here in Florida that Democrats are running on, teacher pay, gun safety, raising the corporate tax rate.
Sure. Well, the theme of the campaign is fairness, and we're really talking about restoring fairness to the system. From an economic standpoint, I went to public schools my whole life. I never had a teacher who was my history teacher and then was my waitress at Chili's and then was working the floor of the garden center on Sunday trying to pay back her student loans or make a living for her family. You know, we had a time when being a teacher was a profession and it paid like that. We need to restore economic fairness to our system. As union membership has declined, the curve of the decline of real wages has matched that curve. We need to find new ways to invigorate unions and labor. There are so many people who are working in the gig economy. Just walk into a Starbucks and see how many people are working on their laptops doing freelance graphic design or doing marketing or PR for companies. These are people who need the ability to collectively bargain, to collectively negotiate for healthcare expenses, to collectively negotiate for 401k rates. We need to address this new type of economy in a way that protects and grows real wages.
And on your website, by the way, there's a complete list of positions at SelmontForCongress.com. Let's go to some more calls for the candidate. 549-2937. Johnny is in Washington Heights. Hi, Johnny. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Awesome. My question is, we've heard a lot about like infrastructure, beach erosion, and stuff like that. What is his policies, and what is going to be his attitude toward the crumbling infrastructure of places like the North Side and the food deserts and things of that nature? That is something that concerns voters as well.
Sure. What about that? Thanks, Johnny.
Wow, Johnny. I think between you and Kathy, you're almost like plants for me. Thank you. You're steering me in the right direction. I spent the last 2 years volunteering with Dr. Nat Glover, Sheriff Glover, up at Edward Waters College in the Newtown neighborhood. And he came to me and he said, we have an opportunity before I retire to ensure that the college is safe moving forward and also to make an impact on this neighborhood. It'll be a great job and I can't pay you. What do you think? And I talked to my wife and we agreed to it. And I spent the last 18 months, almost 2 years working up there, culminating in a neighborhood and a university plan that we got $8.5 million in funding for to transform that neighborhood. Part of what I did on that was to pull together research on the negative health impacts in that zip code. In the Newtown area, where the rates of asthma, the rates of hypertension, rates of diabetes are so much higher than the rest of the city. And one of the things that we realized was there's no opportunity in that neighborhood for either active or passive recreation. I mean, there's no park to go.
No grocery stores.
No grocery store. Certainly a food desert.
The new president of EWC was on this show the other day and said that parents who drop their kids off to go to college, they're sight unseen, took a look around the neighborhood and said, no, you're not going to school here, and just drove off with their kid and said, we'll find you a new school to go to. And so he was very upset about that as the new president of the school, the guy who succeeded Nat Glover. So there are big challenges on the Northwest side.
Absolutely. And think about how important it is to have neighborhoods that ring our city where people can live who work downtown. And I'm not talking about lawyers and stockbrokers. I'm talking about if you work in a building as a maintenance person or on a cleaning crew or an administrative task, if you live all the way down in Orange Park, how can you commute to work 45 minutes and then be involved in your kid's school? How can you stop off at school and bring cupcakes on your child's birthday when you work 45 minutes away from where you live? Or how can you be a volunteer who reads to kids in your school? So we need to get back to where we don't write off neighborhoods in town, where we improve neighborhoods in the urban core so that people can live close to where they work.
And how would you, as congressman for the 4th, how would you direct resources to those neighborhoods?
Sure. The way I would do it is I would be in Al Lawson's office every day my first month in Congress, because he is an experienced Tallahassee legislator. He is a Democrat and he is a congressman for the 5th district. And I think that what we need is Congress people, the power that we have in this area in the First Coast that we don't realize we have with 3 Congress people, we have the ability to get so much done. I-95 that just ripped through downtown, the new improvements to I-95, any other city with a congressional delegation with juice would have buried those ramps, would have left room for light rail or high-speed rail to move through
there. So you think the local delegation doesn't have the juice?
Absolutely. What we do is people complain about a logjam in Washington, and then we've gerrymandered these districts, so we have one Republican and one Democrat for Jacksonville, and we don't get anything done. We have a really unique opportunity this November to have two Democratic congresspeople for Jacksonville, and you'd be amazed at what we can get done with that juice, as long as we reelect Bill Nelson, who has accomplished amazing tasks in his in the minority in the Senate. What he brought home in the budget this year for Florida, Senator Nelson, is amazing. And a guy like Andrew Gillum, what addition by subtraction we can have in this state if we subtract Ron DeSantis, we subtract John Rutherford, and we subtract Rick Scott. And we add someone like Andrew Gillum, we return Bill Nelson, and humbly, if we add me.
Okay, let me ask you as a follow-up. As you mentioned, the district you're running in, which encompasses parts of Duval, Nassau, and St. John's counties, is heavily gerrymandered. Like most districts in Florida, it is skewed to overrepresent white suburban Republican voters. The urban core that we just talked about is more in your the gentleman you mentioned's district, Congressman Al Lawson. So what is your strategy to appeal to solid Republican voters in this district? Because I don't know the exact split of voter registration in the fourth, but I'm guessing it's about 60-40 Republican to Democrat. I need to check that though.
Sure. It's actually 50-50.
It's 50-50 registration?
Yeah, it's 50-50 registration between Republicans and then NPAs or independents and Democrats.
So you're going for those NPA voters.
Yeah, well, we're going for Republican voters. We're going for NPA voters. We're going for Democratic voters. But and St. John's County and Ponte Vedra are obviously very close to my heart. We've lived there for a decade now, my wife and two kids. And what an opportunity it would be for all the Beaches communities to have a congressman from the Beaches. Those areas are much more purple than people think. And they're purple for a couple reasons. The first one is that if you're an NPA and all the peer pressure down here is to be a Republican and you're not, that says that there's something about the Republican Party that you just can't agree with, whether it's their stance on women's health care, whether it's their stance on race issues. There's something about that side that you can't go all the way. So that means there's something from the Democratic side, our side of the menu, that we have for you. And that's what we're trying to do, is appeal to the NPAs who want to be Democrats, but they just haven't come over, and the Democrats who are already tried and true blue.
CJ is in San Marco. Hi, CJ. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Your opponent really has shown somewhat of a hostility towards science. And I know you've talked about this, but actually, Melissa, on your show, John Rutherford actually said around the time when he was running for his election last year, he said that he did not believe that humans were causing climate change. And my question is, I know you've talked about the climate change issue. My question is, what's your stance on the dredging issue, which Melissa has had experts on the show that said that will cause actually more flooding and sea level rise and storm surge and storms. We have a storm out there now. But what's your stance on that? What's your stance on, I know you mentioned renewables, but what's your stance really on pushing solar? I mean, Florida is the sunshine state. And then just sort of a broader question is, how will you help be a check on the Trump administration?
Okay, a lot of questions coming from San Marco this morning. Thanks for that call. Jess, go ahead.
Sure, I don't know if I have these in the right order, but we absolutely have an incredible competitive advantage here in Florida because we can undercut every other state except maybe Arizona on utility costs. So any business that relocates here could really have free power. And that makes us an incredible growth state. And
you mean if we converted more to solar?
Exactly. If we use the sun. So I'm certainly behind building a resilient, clean grid and the clean energy jobs that come with that. As for the port, I just think that what we could have spent $1 billion on in Jacksonville on the ground and in the First Coast, as opposed to spending $1 billion dredging a charge, a channel. Obviously, we have to maintain the port and the channel. But I don't know that that we are looking at that situation. I think we're looking at that situation as being afraid to lose the business we have, as opposed to really visioning where shipping will be in 20 years and preparing for that. For example, nobody anticipated the Trump tariffs and cutting down imports from China. So we're dredging to 50, 55 feet so that ships from China can get into our port. And now we're restricting ships from China. I'm sorry. The last question was a check on Trump. And I'm amazed that we've gotten almost through the end of the segment without being asked about the president.
Right. I think a lot of Democrats right now are hoping for Congress to flip to Democratic control because they see that they believe that the president needs to be checked in his administration. And the only vehicle to do that is through Congress. Republicans, on the other hand, do not want that to happen. And they are very engaged in keeping Republican control of Congress. So how much is the presidency factoring into your campaign when you go out and talk about these issues?
Well, it's a few ways. The first thing is that most everybody, or a large majority, Republican or Democrat, are really distressed by the lack of decorum in the conduct of the president and the way that he has demeaned the office of the presidency. He is acting more like Bobby Riggs, male chauvinist pig, in the last week than he's acting like a leader of the free world. He was laughed at on the stage and at the UN. An important thing to know is that America is the world's policeman. That doesn't mean that we can willy-nilly bring about regime change in any country we feel like it. But when we don't lead the world as a political and moral authority, other countries step into that void. And it's not England and France. The countries that step in are China and Russia and Iran. And we have an obligation to be a world leader and to be a shining city on the hill.
Would you support impeachment proceedings against this president if you are elected to Congress and the Congress flips?
When I'm elected to Congress and Congress does flip, and Robert Mueller presents charges to the Congress, yes, I would certainly.
Do you believe the president has committed impeachable offenses?
I believe that his family has committed criminal offenses, and certainly his staff and advisors have pled guilty. As an attorney, it's reinforced in you that you're not the judge, the jury, and the executioner. And so, you know, my attorney in me says, don't convict somebody before you've heard the charges from the grand jury. But there's a lot of smoke for there not to be any fire. And I would definitely expect that a Democratic Congress would want to look into what this president has done.
Let's go to one more call for Jess Salmont. It's Elizabeth in Jacks Beach. Elizabeth, you're on the air.
Hey, yeah, I was just going to comment that I didn't even know this seat was open. And, you know, I wonder if it's because you ran opposed leading up to the primary, but I see more Cord Byrd and that state House race seat around than anything to do with this upcoming election.
You mean campaign signs?
Yeah, just campaign signs and events. And so I'm just, you know,
sure,
I talked
sure.
to my friends about Gillum, Nelson, Shaw, and I obviously will start talking about you, but because I support everything you're saying, I'm just saying, wow, it's just like doesn't even seem to be on anyone's mind out at the beach, at least.
Yeah, okay. I can address that. I hope you're still listening. Two things. One is that Republican-owned businesses don't let Democrats put their signs up. So we have a large problem. You look at Ponte Vedra, for example, A1A, there's maybe three or four commercial plazas, and then you have gated communities that don't allow signs. So we're up to the mercy of individual property owners if they'll allow us to put Democratic signs on their in their commercial plazas. So that's why Ponte Vedra looks like it's 100% red, but it's actually a purple town. It's just the effect of that. The second thing is that, you know, and I have to tell this story, we've been trying to get press. We actually have been going back and forth with the Times Union, Joe Fenton, one of the editors over there. And he actually sent back word through his admin the other week that, you know, between now, this was September, between the end of September and November 6th, because of budget cuts, we're just not going to have a reporter available to do a story on you. That's what your newspaper told the major party nominee for Congress in a year that all anyone can talk about is Congress. So, you know, we recognize that. What we've done is we've done out-of-the-box things to get press. One of the things we're doing next week is we're doing a unity concert. We're putting on a concert at the Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. We're inviting all the Democratic candidates and anybody who wants to learn about us. And we have a wonderful country singer who's coming down from Nashville who heard about us and volunteered. So we're going to have a concert for Unity next week on Wednesday, October 17th.
Okay. And that's coming up next Wednesday, Ponte Vedra Concert Hall. And we appreciate you being here, sharing a little bit about the campaign. As I mentioned at the top of the hour, we did invite Congressman Rutherford and did not hear back from his office. So, Jess Selmont, we appreciate your time and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's a thrill to be live from Studio 5.
And much more still ahead later. Our book club, as we look at one of the books in the PBS Great American Read. But up next, today's the deadline to register to vote. More about that right after this.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. Knowing your evacuation zone is critical for your safety in a weather emergency. Visit a public library to get your 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide. Stay informed with real-time updates at jaxready.com or download the Jax Ready app to also identify your specific zone and important information. Keep your radio on 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Many places in downtown Jacksonville being considered for demolition or redevelopment have had their histories lost. How can we bring these stories back to life while determining a future for these sites? WJCT, in partnership with Modern Cities, present The Jackson, Forgotten Spaces, Tuesday, October 23rd at WJCT Studios. The evening begins with a reception at 6, followed by a panel discussion at 6:30. RSVP for this free event at wjct.org/events, sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
Welcome back. Well, today is the deadline to register to vote in the upcoming primary election. And if you're registered already, make sure to check your registration status before you go to vote. That's because the state of Florida has dramatically increased the number of people it is purging from the voter rolls. In fact, over the last couple of years, the purge rate in Florida jumped to 7% of all voters. What's going on here? Well, with more about your voting rights, we welcome Deb Couples. She's a professor at UF's Law School and author of the book, It Is About You, How American Government Works and How to Help Fix It. Deb Couples, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So today is the deadline to register to vote. If people don't register by today, they're out of luck. And it's important not only to register, but to check your registration status. Why is Florida purging so many more voters from the rolls lately?
Well, my mind reading machine hasn't been working for the last few months. I haven't actually found anyone to fix it at an affordable price. So I can't tell you why. I can tell you, I did graduate school work on that about 15 years ago, the voter purges before the 2000 election. What I can tell you is there were problems then with people being mistakenly purged. A lot of those errors in the system did not seem to get very well corrected, and now there are different types of errors. So the bottom line is we can't at this late date go in and try to get the state to change the system. What we can do is be proactive, double check our registration, follow up, take screenshots, right, or photographs of whatever registration information comes up on screen. We can try.
Yeah.
Right.
Earlier this summer, the Brennan Center released a study examining voter purge data, and they found that 4 million more people have been purged from the rolls over the between the years 2014 and 2016. A lot of that came because of a Supreme Court ruling that basically overturned a law that required states under the Voting Rights Act, basically states with a poor civil rights record in the South, to get election changes cleared in advance. So Florida falls under that. After the Supreme Court ruled that those states no longer needed to do that, Florida and other states went on a voting purge spree. Now, some voters are purged because some names are purged because someone has moved or died, but often names identified for removal, according to the Brennan Center, are determined by faulty criteria, and a voter could be wrongfully deleted from the rolls. A study by your colleague Daniel Smith at UF, a political scientist, found a higher rate of rejection in mail-in ballots in Florida that were cast by younger people and racial minorities, which seems to suggest that the purges are intended to benefit conservative candidates. There's no proof of that, though. But with all of that said, what should people be doing now to check their status? And if they find that they are have been purged, what are their steps for recourse to make sure that they can cast a ballot?
Right. Well, let me just preface, as you and I, we sort of discussed over email, I've written 9 or 10 op-eds and submitted to various state papers, and 6 of them picked it up. Florida Times Union did not, incidentally. But the point was, if you are purged, actually purged, you have to re-register. Well, today's the last day to do that. And so that's why I started in August going to the various papers and radio shows in Tampa to get people checking in advance. The best you can do now is check your registration today, right? Because today's the last day to register. And if you are not registered, then you can go online to registertovoteflorida.gov. If a listener doesn't remember that, just go to Google and, you know, register to vote in Florida. You'll get there and register today.
Right.
Because and you have to re-register if you're purged.
You also believe that voting by mail is not necessarily a good thing to do, which is interesting because both parties really encourage voters to do that. Why are you not as high on that?
Ooh. Okay. And first of all, I did actually ask an election staffer here, why is it that so many candidates are doing that? It's because it's easier to target likely voters if they have applied for a mail-in ballot. So I understand there's nothing nefarious there as far as people encouraging mail-in voting, but there are problems. You can do it. You have to be very proactive. I'll tell you the problems first. My colleague, Dr. Daniel Smith here at the University of Florida, he did a study looking at the Florida mail-in ballots for 2012 election and 2016 election. And three things. One, among others, one thing was that there are no uniform standards across counties for rejecting mail-in ballots. Okay? And as you mentioned, another one is that there's a higher rejection rate for mail-in ballots for younger people and minorities. And then another finding is that there's a higher rejection rate for mail-in ballots than for in-person ballots. So yeah, it can be risky. One way that it's risky is if you have a signature on your voter registration application, you know, maybe a year ago, maybe 20 years ago, they get your mail-in ballot, they look at the envelope, they try to match the signatures. That's required by statute. Well, these are human beings looking at the two signatures. Are they exactly the same? How much variation is acceptable? And, oh, were you in a rush when you signed one of them but not the other? Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's risky, but people have to do it. Some people have to. They're abroad or they're not very mobile. So may I suggest some steps to try to reduce the risk of problems with mail-in ballots?
Yeah, please.
Okay. Be proactive. That's my main message today. So do it as early as possible. so that if there are problems, you have time to cure them. Okay, make sure that your signature is updated with the election office. Follow up with the election office. You know, call. Hey, I submitted my mail-in ballot 5 days ago. Do you have it? Is there a problem that I need to cure? That sort of thing. And, of course, look for notices from the election office. Right?
Right.
Those are the things you need to do if you want to reduce the risk that your mail-in ballot doesn't count.
And then finally, we know that in 2016, the Russians tried to infiltrate our election systems here in Florida and other states. What are your thoughts about Florida's system of election security?
Well, frankly, and I know that this isn't very practical because of cost, I think that I think that for one thing, tallies should not be transmitted by phone or online. I think that that makes them imminently hackable, right?
Mm-hmm.
If somebody wants to hack, I don't know how to hack, but I know it's about ones and zeros. I would like to see, I know it would be very expensive, but ideally I would like to see paper ballots, and I would like to see tallies maybe brought in from the polling places to the election office. And, yeah, it might take a day or two to tally up, right, the election results.
Right, not necessarily get the results as quickly. But, we are a plum target for hackers, foreign and domestic. Mm-hmm. Florida does have a history at suppressing voting measures that complicates efforts at reform. The infamous election of 2000 has made us really ground zero in the struggle to improve the technology and the security of voting. At the same time, we're dealing in 2018 with efforts to undermine confidence in our voting system. And so that's not a good mix.
No.
a nonpartisan watchdog group called Verified Voting is quoted on this, saying that, you know, everything from whether we're going to restore voting rights for former felons or how we deal with election security. This is all in the back of voters' minds as they go to vote this cycle. It's very striking to see all of these factors converging on this midterm election.
Yes. Yes, I agree. And as I did mention, I got my master's degree doing a final project on the pre-2000 election voter purges. I'm amazed. I'm amazed and disheartened to see that those sorts of errors in the voter purges have not changed in the last 18 years. Newer types of errors, as you mentioned, faulty databases. And, of course, there are other states who seem to have sort of used Florida as a model. So it's not just Florida anymore.
Yeah, but here in Florida, we also had the fight over whether to set up early voting on college campuses.
Yes.
Florida refusing to accept cybersecurity funds in the beginning. After an outcry, they took the money. So there's a lot going on around our vote this cycle. We do appreciate you joining us, Deb Couples, author and professor at Florida UF School of Law. Today's the deadline to register to vote, so register today and make sure your status is active. Deborah, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you.
We'll be right back. That's fine.
Town Jacksonville being considered for demolition or redevelopment have had their histories lost. How can we bring these stories back to life while determining a future for these sites? WJCT, in partnership with Modern Cities, present The Jackson, Forgotten Spaces, Tuesday, October 23rd at WJCT Studios. The evening begins with a reception at 6, followed by a panel discussion at 6:30. RSVP for this free event at wjct.org/events, sponsored in part by Downtown Investment Authority.
on the next Fresh Air, how terrorists, governments, political campaigns, and even street gangs are using social media to push propaganda, disinformation, and fear with real-world consequences. We talk with P.W. Singer and Emerson Brooking, authors of the new book, Like War, The Weaponization of Social Media. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Marco Werman. On The World, we get an outside perspective.
I was born in Yemen.
So many people in Sweden.
Most people in South Africa.
Because getting outside yourself can be a good thing.
Once you move to a different country, you zoom out and you're able to see where is the other person coming from.
It is The World. This afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's one thing to be empathetic in your personal life, but what about at work?
To know, I'm emotionally hooked, and I need to figure out what's going on.
Best-selling author and researcher Brené Brown says practicing vulnerability and wholeheartedness on the job is tough, but it will take your business to new heights.
That is a reckoning. That's a fierce reckoning.
Next time on 1A. Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
The First Coast Connect Book Club is sponsored by San Marco Books and More.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high. Take a look.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, how does literature influence and reflect our culture? Well, you can join our own book club leader, Stacy Goldring, for an enriching conversation about that. It's coming up soon here in Jacksonville. We've got a preview right now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. How are you?
Good. So this is something you're doing called the Literature Series. What is this all about?
Well, I think everyone needs to take a deep breath. Our country right now, it has a great new slogan, and it should be on every T-shirt, and it should say, I'm tribal. And about over a year ago, I sat down with art historian, art lecturer Cindy Edelman, and we were both so flummoxed. What do we do? Everyone's running to their corners, et cetera. No one's speaking to one another. And I know this guy. He's a carpenter. And I don't care what I tell him is wrong with my house. He says, I have a solution for that. And using his own talents, he fixes it. Now, he doesn't sue the roofer. He doesn't go ahead and try to get the money back from the flooring guy. He just uses his talents and tries to make the home a better place. And I'm following his lead. I know books. That's all I know. I know nothing about politics. I know none of that. But I do know about books. So Cindy knows a lot about art. So what we've decided is to put together a series of four programs. And these programs talk about how art, American literature, reflect and influence who we all are. We have a lot in common from sea to shining sea. It is reflected in art. And it is reflected in the written word. And we're going to talk about that.
That's amazing. We do have so much more in common than the things that divide us.
And that's what we have to recognize.
Yes, we do.
So here's a starting point, because I figure this. If you like Catch-22 and I like Catch-22, it's a start. If you enjoy a beautiful painting that you saw when you were young that moved you, I don't know a lot about painting, so I'm making generalizations, in some art, let's say at the Toledo Museum of Art, and someone else did, I don't really care what your politics are. We are Americans, and this belongs to us. And that is an amazing thing. And I refuse to give up on our collective, beautiful, painful American experience, because in the end, it belongs to us. Sometimes I think there's a reason why we were called the United States of America, because then you have the U and the S. You know, I'm crazy about this kind of stuff. And that's us. That's us. So Cindy and I are going to take everyone on a journey an aptly titled program next week called Rebels, Outlaws, and Troublemakers. And this program will be about art that caused trouble, about books that were banned, about things, about literature and arts that really upset our culture at the time. And now we call our own, and we are proud of these beautiful pieces that have been created.
Now they're classics. What are a couple of examples?
Well, I can talk to you from the book end. Ooh, the book end. I'm going to be discussing Huckleberry Finn.
Nice.
Okay. Our series will include Harper Lee. See, I have a t-shirt on with all these Southern art, see, Southern authors, Zora, Eudora, Flannery, Harper Lee. We're going to be discussing biblical influences, because the Bible has reflected all types of arts. We're going to talk about Holocaust remembrance, because that is a passion that both Cindy and I share. And then we have a program called This Land Is Your Land. And this is going to be that true Americana that we can all embrace and get our arms around. And it's going to be a place, Melissa, where we can come together as Americans, your politics, your religion, I'm not interested. Let's go ahead and celebrate what we own and we are together.
That sounds great. So people need to come to the kickoff of this series,
right,
coming up next week, mm-hmm, at Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church.
That's right. We have two Rebels programs this week. The first one will be at what I affectionately call HAB, mm-hmm, and that will start at 6:15 on Tuesday the 16th. And then the following night will be at Congregation Ahavath Hesed, and that will start at 7 p.m., Rebels, Outlaws, and Troublemakers, because that's what I am. And it is open to the public, and we would love to have everyone come and be a part of our conversation.
Come on out and see our book club leader, Stacy Goldring, and her co-leader on this, Cindy Edelman. This is coming up next week at Hendricks Avenue Baptist and Ahavath Kesed, both on San Jose Boulevard.
That's right. And if you want more information, you can call or text 904-419-9915, or just email me at books@chapterendnotes.com or book club at wjct.org.
Right. Okay.
Many ways to get in touch with me.
Thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome.
And have fun with that. Thanks. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Our theme by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is 89.9. Thanks for listening. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.